Good evening. We have had an incredible day. For those of you who are just coming tonight, I would imagine you can feel the sacred space here. It has been truly an amazing time together. Very deep, very authentic, and we have had the privilege of hearing some incredible wisdom from elders and from people who are speaking with sincerity and truth about the topic that we'll discuss tonight. So I'm very excited for those of you who are just coming tonight to get a taste of what we have experienced today. My name is Jan Elfers. I'm the Interim Executive Director of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. Through Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon's community of congregations, interreligious organizations, people of faith, and all people of goodwill, we engage together in a ministry of peace, justice, and the healing of God's creation. And oh, how we need healing. We are especially grateful to the Collins Foundation for their generous underwriting of this annual lecture. Thank you so much. I would also like to thank our other 14 sponsors who are listed on the back page of your program. Without all of your contributions, this event would not have been possible. We give you our sincerest thanks. Tonight, we will again explore together the history of the doctrine of discovery and examine its continued influence on relations among church, tribe, and state through lecture and discussion. We are so blessed once again to have wise scholars, tribal leaders and representatives, and spiritual guides to lead us on this journey tonight. I'd like to now please welcome Bishop Michael Hanley of the Episcopal Diocese of Oregon to bring us greetings.
Thank you, Jan. Welcome to the cathedral. We are glad you're here. And I particularly want to say a word of welcome to those who've been here all day and sat on those lovely pews for the entire time you've been here. They were not meant to be sat on for entire days, and you are so gracious to do this with us, so thank you very much for that. Now, some of you have been here all day, and so what I'm about to say next is probably not as important to you as maybe for those of you who are new to this space tonight, but one of the things I'm supposed to tell you is where the bathrooms are. So, there are some bathrooms on this side, there are more bathrooms on this side, and there are none in the back. So don't head to the back. That will not help. In the Episcopal tradition, we believe that a cathedral is both a parish community and also a diocesan gathering place. This is a holy space where we have gathered as a diocese for over 100 years, and we've gathered to do things like elect bishops and argue and discuss things that are important to us and celebrate wonderful moments in our common life together. And so this is a very important place. We believe that even those who are not a part of this congregation but are a part of our other Episcopal congregations, that for them, this is a home away from home where they can come and be a part of the community. But we also believe it is more than that. We also believe it's a place of gathering for the city of Portland and really for the entire Pacific Northwest. This is a place that should be a place where we can come and we can discuss and we can talk and we can pray and we can worship and we can reflect together as community in ways that will make the whole place a better place to be. We really do think of it as a home away from home. So what we hope is that tonight you will relax and maybe take a deep breath and enjoy this as your home away from home for at least the next couple of hours. This is a place where we feed the hungry, those who have in need of food show up in this space, and those who are hungry for knowledge or for conversation need to be able to be here as well. So I am privileged to be a part of the diocese and a part of this cathedral, and we are so grateful for your presence here this evening. It is a place for all, those who doubt and those who are devout and those who are questioning and those who come to us from other cultures and other religious traditions. This is where we gather, hopefully, we believe, to be a community together. So, as I said, relax. Think of this as your home away from home and enjoy the evening. Thank you.
And now I'd like to introduce our co-moderators for this evening's event. First, the Reverend Dr. Randy Woodley, Katua Cherokee, is Distinguished Professor of Faith and Culture and Director of Intercultural and Indigenous Studies at George Fox Evangelical Seminary. Randy has graciously given many, many hours to help in the planning of this event. It has been my great pleasure to work with and learn from Randy. Thank you. Very, very much. Our second moderator is the Reverend Dr. Pat Ross, who is a member of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon's Theological Education and Dialogue Committee and Pastor Emerita of the First Congregational Church of Christ, United Church of Christ in Portland. She has also helped plan this event from the very beginning, and I am very grateful to her for her skills and wise counsel. I invite you to come forward.
One of the things Reverend Hanley didn't mention was what an incredible garden this cathedral has. It's really fruitful. And I'm thinking maybe some of that squash might have been picked right here. I'm not sure. But I know the person we've asked to come up and say a prayer, Marcus Luke, mentioned that he really liked that squash. So I think maybe somebody should go back and get him something he can take home with him. He's got a long drive all the way back up to Umatilla. So let me introduce Marcus L. Luke II. Has served as General Counsel Vice Chairman for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation from 2009 to 2015. He also works for the Housing Department on the CTUIR, Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, since 2005 to present. And KCUW Tribal Radio Station and award-winning tribal newspaper, the Confederated Umatilla Journal, from 99 to 2005. He's actively one of the leaders in the Longhouse and participates in numerous ceremonies, namings, funerals, memorials, first food ceremonies, and is a proud father of a 13-year-old track star named M. Aaron Luke. Thank you for coming and sharing a prayer with us today. Dr. Cornel P. Wawarty is a professor at Portland State University in Comanche, Kiowa. He's an enrolled member of the Comanche Nation of Oklahoma. Dr. P. Wawarty served as a postdoctoral fellow in the Center for Multi-Ethnic Education at the University of Oklahoma. Prior to joining Portland State University, he was associate professor in the Department of Teaching and Leadership and Center for Indigenous Nation Studies at the University of Kansas, as well as adjunct faculty in American Indian Studies at Haskell Indian Nations University. From 2005 to 2007, Dr. P. Wawarty was the Dean of Academic Instruction at the Comanche Nation College in Lawton, Oklahoma. Even though Cornell is a renowned academic figure, he also serves his people, both the Comanche Nation and the Kiowa tribe of Oklahoma, by being a repository, or we would say a keeper, of his traditional songs. And we're grateful to have him share one of those today and whatever else he wants to share.
Thank you.
I have been asked to sort of recap for those who weren't here earlier today. How many of you would that be? Raise your hand if you've just come in this evening. Oh, quite a few. Wow. So we just changed. All the people who were here took off, and all the ones who weren't came in. So, okay. So I was asked to give a little recap because there's a lot of things you miss by being at work today or being out on the lake fishing or whatever it was that you were doing. And so we were very honored beyond words today to have our northern grandparents come up and share with us this morning a ceremony that asked permission to come into the land and honored, and it was very honoring and very touching. And then we were given prayers and songs from people as gifts, and then we gave away. So on behalf of the committee and the executive committee and the board today of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, they wanted to, in a native way, they wanted to try and find meet the culture at least halfway. And one of the ways that our indigenous people, really all over the world, I've found this, but especially in North America, we have a value, an ingrained value, to be hospitable and to be generous. And so gifts were given out today from Emo to participants and guests and strangers and others and people who are affiliated with tribes and people who are lineal descendants of chiefs and others from this area. And so we did this, what we would say, in a good way. We wanted to make sure that this thing is done in a good way and it gets off on, as you say, a good foot. So I appreciate so much everything that Jan and the committee and all the staff have done to try and create an atmosphere where indigenous people could come in a church, because that's very difficult for some people to do, and to be able to feel, as Cornell said, open hearts and open minds. And so this has been, for me, it's been a good day. I felt good. I've been brought to tears a few times. I had some good belly laughs a few times. And then we've been fed well. And I don't know, the only thing that could make this better is if they would have had coffee here all day. So besides that, I think, maybe next time. So it's been a really, really good day. And we also want to just say that on behalf of Emo, that they are grateful that all of you have come in tonight. Thank you.
So this is the 44th annual Collins Lecture. The Collins Lectures have been going on for these 44 years, and they are addressed to issues of social justice and matters of faith. Over the years, we've heard from people like Karen Armstrong, Richard Rohr, Archbishop Tutu, Bill McKibben, and many, many others, and I'm going to just go out on a limb right now and say, I doubt if any of those speakers have given us more depth and thoughtful presentation than we've heard today and that you will hear this evening. This has been a very special time. Now, in the next little bit of time, I'm going to introduce one by one the three speakers, and then they will come up and present their material in about 20 minutes. And then after they have each presented their 20 minutes of material, then they will sit with Randy on these chairs and have a discussion and also address some of the questions that people have turned in. So I'm going to start by introducing Robert Miller. Robert Miller is a professor at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law in Arizona, Arizona State University. His areas of expertise include federal Indian law, American Indians and international law, American Indian economic development and natural resources. He is a member of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma. He's the Chief Justice of the Court of Appeals for Oregon's Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, and he sits as a judge for other tribes as well. He has written a book, a very important book, that looks at the discovery principle. He makes the case that Thomas Jefferson used the discovery principle in conceiving and launching the Lewis and Clark expedition. And I'm not going to say any more about that because he says it so much better. So let's welcome now Robert Miller.
Well, I only have 20 minutes and I had an hour and 15 minutes this morning, so I'm going to talk really fast. And also, I don't have the PowerPoint, and I gave my notes away to someone. Who did I give my notes to? Are they still here? Because I need those back. She's not here. Okay, well, I cobbled together some notes, and it is going to be a little harder without PowerPoint because visual learning. You know why it's going to be harder? I read in the New York Times that when you use PowerPoint, people think you're 10% smarter than you really are. And I need all the help in the world. So I'm going to talk briefly. I'm a law professor. I've written several books about the doctrine of discovery, and I'm going to explain what it is, and then the other speakers will present on the topics that they did, and then we're going to take some questions, I guess, which have been selected from both this morning and for those of you this afternoon or this evening. What is the doctrine of discovery? Well, if I had PowerPoint, I'd show you the first United States Supreme Court case called Johnson v. McIntosh. No Indians, no tribes were involved in the lawsuit, but it was an extremely important question that is still the law to this day. Johnson v. McIntosh is the law of the land. Supreme Court decision from 1823, in which no tribe was involved, no lawyer there was arguing for the tribes. It was just two American citizens, non-Indians, arguing over what used to be tribal lands. And so to short-circuit it, the court adopted and called this legal principle the doctrine of discovery. And that's what we call it today. Our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, the first Congress of the United States, knew this legal principle as preemption. And it was international law that European countries used to claim land and rights all around the world. But Johnson v. McIntosh is an extremely important case. It's been cited more than 60 times by courts in Canada, more than 50 times by courts in Australia, and more than 40 times by courts in New Zealand, and has even been cited by the English Privy Council, which is sort of like the Supreme Court of England. Well, what did it tell us? It claimed that Europeans acquired title over the lands of indigenous peoples the moment they showed up and stuck their flag and cross in the soil. Oh, and I neglected to say this. I know some of you were here this morning, so I'm trying to present some new information that you didn't hear me say this morning, but of course I'm trying to fill everyone in on sort of the basics to know what we're talking about. So what was that sticking the flag and cross in the soil? You've seen those paintings. Columbus, John Cabot, every explorer that went around the world, they stuck something in the soil to claim that land, to claim sovereignty and property rights over the indigenous peoples, peoples that were considered heathen, savage, uncivilized, and so not worthy to be full-fledged nations in the world of nations. So if I had my PowerPoint, I'd show you the 10 elements that I think Johnson v. McIntosh, and remember what we're talking about, an 1823 Supreme Court case in which the United States Supreme Court held, and it's still the law today, that when Europeans showed up, they claimed and acquired property rights over indigenous peoples, they acquired commercial rights over indigenous peoples and nations, and they acquired diplomatic and commercial rights. Did I say that already? Sovereign rights, excuse me, over indigenous peoples. And in all of the countries of the English colonies, here, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and in everywhere that Spain and Portugal colonized, this legal principle applied and mostly still applies today. American Indian nations today, folks, do not own the full ownership of their lands. They hold their lands, maybe you've heard this, in trust status. The United States is deemed to be the legal owner of tribal lands, and the tribe is only the beneficial owner. Why? If you were writing an exam for me at law school, the authority you would cite me would be Johnson v. McIntosh, 1823, the doctrine of discovery, international law that was developed by Europeans that wanted to acquire land and assets outside of Europe. So I define 10 elements that make up the doctrine of discovery, but I only want to talk about three of them now, and especially since we have less time than I did this morning. The three crucial ones that we're talking about all start with a C, interestingly enough. The doctrine of discovery was justified based on Christianity and civilization, the fact that indigenous peoples didn't have any, according to European legal regimes. And the third aspect, the third C element of my 10 elements that I argue make up the doctrine of discovery, I call conquest. And then we also don't have our beautiful little brochure, but the beautiful title of this session tonight, The Gospel of Conquest. What an oxymoron that is, or dichotomy. What a clash. The gospel, the love of Christ or whatever, the love of the New Testament, but it's conquest. What are you talking about? So that's an allusion to these elements, or a reference, excuse me, of conquest under the doctrine of discovery. And what the United States Supreme Court held in 1823 was that when European Christians traveled around the world and stuck their flag and cross in the soil, it was as if they had just won a war against those indigenous peoples, those indigenous nations. And so the European Christian countries claimed to have acquired property rights, sovereignty rights, and commercial rights over indigenous peoples. So Christianity was the prime justification, and I think I already said that civilization was one of the prime justifications for Europeans to claim these rights. Let me read you just a tiny portion out of Johnson v. McIntosh. I didn't read this morning, so those of you who are still here, this is new. This opinion was written by our most famous Chief Justice, John Marshall. I dare say most of you probably know his name. That's how important he was to American history. He was the Chief Justice for 34 years and wrote many of the early important opinions. Well, he also wrote the early and very important Indian law case of Johnson v. McIntosh. Here's what he said, quote, "On the discovery of this immense continent, the great nations of Europe were eager to appropriate to themselves so much of it as they could respectively acquire." So he admitted the great nations of Europe wanted to divide the Americas up. Lots of riches. He says its vast extent offered an ample field to the ambition and enterprise of all. And then, "And the character and religion of its inhabitants," us, the Indians, "our character and our religion afforded an apology for considering them," Indian peoples, "a people over whom the superior genius of Europe might claim an ascendancy." So I hope that wasn't, wish I had PowerPoint. That's a lot to hear. What did John Marshall say? The nations of Europe wanted to divide the lands and the riches and the assets and the gold and the silver and the timber and the fish and whatever there is. They wanted it. And so as an apology, they relied on the character and religion of indigenous peoples. Wow. Let me finish you the rest of that quote. "The potentates of the old world, Europe, found no difficulty in convincing themselves that they made ample compensation to the inhabitants of the new world by bestowing on them civilization and Christianity." I'll take my land back, keep your religion and your civilization. My tribe was from the Ohio area. This great ancestor of mine was born in what's now Springfield, Ohio. I'll take Springfield, Ohio back. Keep your Christianity, keep your religion, or keep your civilization. So see how John Marshall is admitting what Europeans had developed into international law, folks. And the doctrine of discovery is still international law today. In fact, it was almost the first. In fact, I didn't say this today. Remember what Russia did on August the 2nd, 2007? Don't any of you remember? Stuck its flag on the bottom of the North Pole. Why? To claim the oil and gas that is estimated to be under the North Pole. 25% of the world's known reserves of oil and gas are under the North Pole, and the race is on now to exploit it and acquire it. Do you know what China did in the summer of 2010? Planted its flag on the bottom of the South China Sea. You do know, right, that China's really aggressively pushing its claims to sovereignty in the South China Sea. Do you know it's literally building islands, sand islands out there, and putting buildings on them? Wow, for those of you who were here this morning, what's the second element of the doctrine of discovery? It's to actually occupy these vacant lands or the lands of indigenous peoples that Europeans found. China and Russia are literally replicating what Columbus and all these other conquistadors and explorers did in the 1500s. Do you know the Danish minister, when Russia planted that flag in 2007, the Danish foreign minister laughed and he said, "This isn't the 15th century anymore. You can't go around the world sticking your flag in stuff and claiming it." And Russia said, "Well, we just did." So maybe that was just purely a symbolic act. But for what I've been researching and writing about for years, I about fell over when I first heard that. I was giving a speech on the Lummi Reservation, and someone in the front row said, "Well, did you see what Russia did this morning?" And I went, "No, what?" Stuck a flag in the... I ran back to the hotel, wrote an editorial, and got it published in the L.A. Times. So, okay, thank you, Russia. Okay, so where am I? I'm going to need way more than 20 minutes, Jan, because I'm literally saying more and different things than I did this morning. I have to read you just what two other state courts said, folks. It's almost offensive to read today. But this is what early Americans were thinking and in applying the doctrine of discovery. So I have a statement from the 1835 Tennessee Supreme Court. And in fact, it was written by a Tennessee state judge who later went on the U.S. Supreme Court. So he's not some crackpot. But here's what he wrote. He said, quote, the state of Tennessee could apply its criminal law to Indians on reservations in Tennessee. He said, because it's, quote, the law of Christendom that the state possessed sovereign power over Indians, the unconverted natives of Africa, Asia, and North and South America. So he said, we have the right to enforce state criminal law on Indians because you are savages and you're unconverted natives. Someone else on his court also wrote, I threw these pages together at the last second, I guess I scratched that part out. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court in 1813 said that Indians could not own land because, quote, not being Christians, but mere heathens, they are unworthy of the earth, period, close quote. Sounds ugly today, doesn't it, right? So I'm not just going for the ugly sound of it, but I'm talking about the law and how we use the law and how international law was used against indigenous peoples everywhere. European Christians claimed these rights in Africa, Asia, Europe, or excuse me, here in South America too. So I said I gave my notes away today, so I'm literally using like an alternate backup version, and I've written numbers and I have to turn pages to flip back and forth to catch up to where I... Sorry. So where did the doctrine of discovery come from? And this is what I pointed out far more today. It started early. It started literally in the idea of the Crusades. And I didn't say this morning, but the idea was that Pope Innocent IV in 1240, who was a canon lawyer, which means church lawyer, and he became pope, and he made some very important writings about the rights of the church to invade the Holy Lands and to attack the infidels there. And what an interesting justification he used. He said, it's not an offensive war. We are only defending Christendom by attacking the infidels in the Middle East. That led to justifications for the doctrine of discovery. It led to justifications for just war, holy war, in other instances too. And it led to the development of the idea that the Pope had responsibility for the entire earthly flock and also had certain authority and power over the entire earthly flock. So to jump ahead, it leads to what? Portugal and Spain start to compete about discoveries of new lands outside the side of Europe. Primarily, they start arguing about the Canary Islands in the 1430s, and they look to the Pope to settle their argument. And at first, the Pope says, no, neither of you can go there. Those people are people, they're humans, they have their rights. But Portugal convinced the Pope in 1436 to grant them a papal bull that is called Romanus Pontifex, and the Pope granted Portugal the right to colonize, Christianize, and civilize the Canary Island peoples. Portugal took that authority, and then in subsequent decades, as it explored down the west coast of Africa, it returned to the Pope, saying, boy, we're finding gold and new foods and new spices and slaves, and we want rights to take and keep these assets. And so in 1452, 1453, and 1455, Pope Nicholas V extended Romanus Pontifex and granted Portugal rights to acquire title, sovereignty, and jurisdiction in these new lands they're acquiring. And I had a quote this morning that the audience gasped a bit. The papal bull in 1455 said that Portugal could, and now I'm trying to paraphrase, take, acquire, capture, kill all Saracens, pagans, take their lands, their dominions, their principalities, throw them into perpetual slavery, and it's all yours. So that's what the doctrine of discovery was. That's the, dare I say, the genesis? that's a joke. Dare I say that was the genesis of the doctrine of discovery from the papal bulls that the Pope had this earthly power. Notice that Portugal was getting all these papal bulls early on, and Spain was eager to get its share of new lands and slaves and treasures. And so when Columbus comes to the court of Isabella and Ferdinand in the 1490, 1488, he's trying to talk them into funding him to go west. And he ultimately sails west under 7 contracts he signs with Isabella and Ferdinand. You all learned in school, of course, he was going west to find spices, right? Guess what the contract said? We will make you, Columbus, the admiral over any land you, quote, discover and acquire for us. He was looking for new lands. And, of course, he did stumble onto some islands in the Caribbean. I guess he thought he was in India because he called us Indians. Is that right? Aren't you glad he didn't think he was in Turkey? Boy, that's an old one. You guys are a good audience. So now the Spanish go to the new Pope, Pope Alexander VI. And in 1493, he issues 4 papal bulls, Intercaterra Divinia I, Intercaterra Divinia II, and 2 others I don't know the name of. But he divides the world in half for the Spanish and the Portuguese, and he draws a line from the North Pole to the South Pole. Did you know they knew about the poles in 1493? But anyway, Portugal is to have all rights east of that line to explore, conquer, and acquire sovereignty, jurisdiction, and title. And Spain is to have all rights west of that line to explore, conquer, and acquire sovereignty, jurisdiction, and title. And I think I left out the word convert, too, right? Because this papal bull said that all this laudable and holy work is being done to expand the Christian rule. That's what Pope Alexander VI was thinking. Go convert, go acquire, conquer new lands, increase the size of Christendom. So that's what the doctrine of discovery was about. But amazingly enough, the U.S. Supreme Court adopts it as American law in 1823. And it's still the law today. The U.S. Supreme Court cited Johnson v. McIntosh approvingly in 2005 in a recent case, obviously. So did England, England's primarily the country that colonized what is now the United States. Did England use the doctrine of discovery? Well, yes, it did. At first, Henry VII, you may not know this, Henry VIII's the famous guy, but Henry VII was a Catholic monarch, and he was very worried about violating the papal bulls that I just discussed that were issued in 1493. But England was desirous of acquiring new lands and assets. And so he sends John Cabot. I'm sure most of you know who John Cabot is. In 1496 and 1498, under charters for Cabot to sail west, they knew North America was here. They had been fishing off the banks of Greenland, fishing off the banks of Newfoundland since like the 1300s. So they knew there was a landmass here. And so John Cabot is sent west to go where no Christian prince has yet been, and Henry VII orders, and acquire for me sovereignty, jurisdiction, and title. So John Cabot goes west, and just as he's ordered, he stops along the east coast from Newfoundland, probably as far south as Virginia, going ashore every once in a while, flag and cross, flag and cross, flag and cross. Oh, we'll be back. This is ours now. We'll be back. Elizabeth I is excommunicated. She's no longer Catholic. And I didn't say this today, but it's interesting she continues to comply with this emerging international law. She doesn't care what the Pope says. So why does she comply, though, with international law? Because she wants the other countries of the world to recognize where England claims discovery rights. So she sends various explorers west. I also didn't mention this morning. The first English attempt to colonize in North America was Roanoke Island in 1587 when Sir Walter Raleigh and Sir Humphrey Gilbert were chartered to attempt a colony in Roanoke Island. What were they ordered to do? Go where no Christian prince has yet been. So stay away from where Spain and Portugal are, but find virgin land with just indigenous peoples on it and claim it and establish a colony. And what did Elizabeth I say? Acquire for me sovereignty, jurisdiction, and title. Then her successor, James I, he charters the Jamestown colony, ultimately established 1607. He charters the New England colony, the Plymouth colony, the Massachusetts Bay colony. What does he tell them all? Remember, he's not a Catholic monarch. He's also Protestant, but he follows this emerging international law. Go where no other Christian prince has yet been and acquire for me sovereignty, jurisdiction, and title. And James I also said, convert the miserable heathen infidels who do not have the knowledge of the one true God. So religion was long not only a justification for European claims around the world, but also a justification for what made European empire and European colonization look good, because supposedly they were here to civilize us and Christianize us. Like I made the joke earlier, I'll take Springfield, Ohio back, keep that other stuff. Okay, I'm almost done. I'm sure I've talked way over 20 minutes, right? But I talked a little short this morning because I got shorted a little. So, I didn't fly all this way from Phoenix to be shorted 5 minutes, so I'll take my 5 minutes now. But let me tell you what, in my first book, I think I argued something new. First off, the idea of breaking the doctrine of discovery into these 10 distinct elements make it far more understandable, and then you can look to future and other historical events, what looks like the doctrine of discovery. So I argue in my book that manifest destiny is the doctrine of discovery. And what I forgot to ask today, just that answer in your head, but what is manifest destiny? American manifest destiny. It gets mentioned to us in grade school. Maybe we hear something about it in high school, sophomore year, U.S. history. What is it? So I gave the quote today of the three of historians. They define American manifest destiny in three ways. And I'm going by memory because I don't have it here either. Americans are special, and we have special virtues, and our institutions are special. It's our duty to remake the world in our image. Now, I didn't say this morning either, but when was that, 05 that we invaded Iraq? If I was braver, I would have written an editorial at that time saying that it looks like we were trying to take American manifest destiny to Iraq. Didn't we say we were going to Christianize them and we were taking Bibles? And didn't we, at least some Christian groups were saying that? And didn't we say we're going to take democracy to the Middle East? Sounds like American manifest destiny. But the third element of what historians define manifest destiny is that the United States has a divine destiny to accomplish those tasks. If that's not the doctrine of discovery, then I don't know what is. So I'm just about done. But what did manifest destiny do to American Indians then? Let me read you a little piece from the first time the words manifest destiny were used were by a New York editorial writer, but very influential. In July of 1845, he used the phrase for the first time writing about Texas. Remember, Texas was an independent country in essence at that time, and we were claiming it. And he said, we own it because God means us to own Texas. It's our manifest destiny. But I want to read you what he said about the Oregon country, where you're sitting. In December 27, 1845, John L. O'Sullivan writes this editorial. The phrase manifest destiny was literally repeated on the floor of the House of Representatives 9 days later. That's how influential this idea became. The Oregon Trail, the movement to get the Pacific Northwest, etc. This is slightly long, but there's so much in here. He goes, quote, our legal title to Oregon is perfect. And he's talking about old black letter law. He's talking about Dr. Discovery. He says it in a funny way. He goes, we have a still better title than any that can ever be constructed out of all these antiquated materials of old black letter international law. He's talking about the doctrine of discovery. He says, we already own the Oregon country under old black letter international law. He says, away, away with all these cobweb tissues of right of discovery. He's talking to doctrine. He's talking my elements, the doctrine of discovery. Those of you who are here this morning, remember my 10 elements? Exploration, settlement, contiguity. Those were all some of my 10 elements this morning. He says our claim to Oregon is by the right of our manifest destiny to overspread and to possess the whole of the continent which Providence has given us. He says, in England's hands, Oregon must always remain wholly useless and worthless for any purpose of human civilization or society. The God of nature and of nations has marked it for our own, and with his blessing, we will firmly maintain the incontestable rights he has given. American manifest destiny didn't have a lot good in store for indigenous peoples. But I argue to you that it was nothing more than the doctrine of discovery that traces its lineage to the papal bulls that divided the world for the Spanish and the Portuguese. The future for indigenous peoples was going to be bad. The future for indigenous peoples and nations in the U.S. has been bad. It's time for us to know that it's still the law today. It's still the controlling and dominant feature of federal Indian law, the United States relationship with American Indians. All of us need to know our history better. All of us need to know what there is we could do about it and what should be done about it. Should Johnson v. McIntosh and the doctrine of discovery still be the law of the United States? Thank you very much.
Our next speaker is George Tink Tinker, professor of American Indian culture and religious tradition at Iliff School of Theology in Denver, Colorado. He's an enrolled member of the Osage Nation. He's been an activist and spiritual leader in urban American Indian communities for many years. His scholarly endeavors encompass both, this is good, the liberation of the Indian peoples from their historic oppression to colonized communities, and the liberation of white Americans from their role as oppressors. He's written about Native American theology, and he's also a member of the Evangelical Lutheran Church. George.
Good evening. I'm honored to be here. And I do want to report to you all that in Indian protocol, I received permission to speak here to you all this afternoon from a woman elder that was here from the Umatilla Confederacy, Catherine Harris. And it's under that authority that I continue to speak tonight. If I saw her here, I would ask her again, just for the sake of those of you who are here for the first time. It's really an important protocol because this is not my land. It's important for me as an Osage to remember whose land this was. As I told people this afternoon, we're on Episcopalian property, but it's Indian land. Wakonda Monchita, Wakonda Utsede Tachi Topa, Wakonda Giblinde, we ach no, we tsikwe, ski ikwe. We watch him, it's equal to knowing you. I am an Osage, Blinde Wajaja, Blinde Gromatwanto. I'm a member of the Bald Eagle clan. Again, an important piece of information to identify myself, especially among Indian people, although it might not mean much to my white relatives. And Pat, thank you for recognizing that I'm a member of the ELCA. I'm not sure they want to claim me that much. Because, Dakhli, thank you for that. I am what's called a mixed blood. That is, you know, I'm Indian on my father's side, and on my mother's side, I'm Lutheran. And the two haven't always sat well with one another. And I've had to make some choices along the way about where I would invest my life and my energies. And I continue to talk to Christians of all stripes. I teach in a Methodist seminary, and I certainly include Lutherans in my conversations. I'm not sure they'd be real happy that you called me a member, even though technically, legally, it's true, and I can call on a lawyer to fight that case for me. Bob will represent me, I'm sure. People want to know where Osages came from. Well, we're in Oklahoma, northeastern Oklahoma, just above Tulsa. Reservation lands actually dip down into Tulsa a bit, even though all that land is now owned by rich white oil people, citizens of Tulsa. But that wasn't our original land. I mean, it was. We went that far south. But originally, we controlled all of modern-day Missouri, a little bit of Kansas, north of the Missouri River a short ways, all the way down to the Arkansas River, into this, what's now called the state of Arkansas. And in 1803, the United States bought our land from the French. We ain't figured that one out yet. How'd they buy our land from the French? The Louisiana Purchase, right? Well, what the United States bought from Napoleon Bonaparte in 1803 was the Louisiana Territory right of discovery. They became the Christian nation heirs of the French possession of the right of discovery of that whole territory, which the French had acquired from the Spanish just before that, so you can see Christian nations were busy trading Osage land right and left without talking to the Osages. That's how that works. Because you see, as Bob was saying, the Osages never deserved to have that land anyway because we were pagans. Shortly after 1803, 5 years later, after Billy Clark got back from the mouth of the Columbia River, he became the territorial governor of Missouri Territory and immediately went about negotiating the first treaty with the Osage Nation. And we signed 7 treaties in 49 years, each one signed with the legal language of in perpetuum, meaning forever and ever, amen, right? Each time giving up a bigger piece of property in return for a smaller piece of property and certain promises for the health, education, and welfare of Osage peoples, until finally, after the era of treaty signing, when the United States decided in 1871 summarily that they would no longer continue the ruse of signing treaties with Indian nations, we were moved from the south of Kansas into Oklahoma. The ruse of treaty negotiations with Indian people. Now, do you all know this U.S. Constitution? You familiar with that document? And what does that document say about treaties? The highest law of the land. It supersedes all other legal discourse in the United States. Unless we're signing a treaty with Indians, then it's just a ruse, a game that we play in order to get their land and move them out. And politicians persistently talked about it during the 19th century as a ruse. Talked about it as a sleight of hand, talked about it as trickery with Indian people because we weren't smart enough to know that they had their fingers crossed behind their back when they signed that treaty with us. That's what the Doctrine of Discovery did to Osage people and continues to do to us repeatedly because it's still the law of the land. But it's more than that. It isn't just about Osages, it's about everyone in this room. It's about all my mother's relatives, the white people that are in this room, because it frames how you live in your world and how you walk on this earth. Because you see, Johnson v. McIntosh is not just the foundation for all Indian law. Ultimately, it's the foundation of all property ownership law in the United States. Think about that. If you own a home, you're a beneficiary of the Doctrine of Discovery. You're benefiting from that law of Christian discovery, and it is Christian discovery, right? One scholar calls it not the doctrine of discovery, but the doctrine of Christian discovery, because as the way the law is written, whichever representative of whichever Christian prince first happens upon a non-Christian territory, that Christian prince, that Christian sovereign, has the right to treat with the natives over the disposition of their land. It was a way for European Christians to divide up the goodies amongst themselves. And ultimately, why you have, or you and your mortgage company have title to a piece of property. See, it frames what you're doing without even thinking about it. It's so deeply embedded in the narrative glue that holds this country together, so that whenever we're hearing discourse about the private property rights in the political realm, they're talking about the doctrine of discovery, whether they know it or not. When they're talking about the sanctimony, the sacredness of private property, again, they're talking about the doctrine of discovery. And as I said earlier today, it's not just that, but the Constitution is written in such a way as to frame the importance of private property over against all other fundamental rights, including human rights. The right to property comes before human rights in this country. Think about that. The United States was slow to jump on the bandwagon internationally in terms of human rights discourse, and only jumped on the bandwagon when they figured out they can criticize rogue nations, that's nations we don't like, for their human rights abuses. As long as the fingers don't point back at the self, right, in terms of the United States human rights abuses, especially in terms of American Indians, let alone of other peoples of color, African peoples under slavery here, etc. So I'm trying to think what I can say to those of you that didn't hear us speak this afternoon, and won't be boring to those of you who did hear all that other stuff. I think part of the problem is, if I can, and we got into this a little this afternoon, in this framing of life around property ownership, we begin to introduce words that don't have currency in the Indian world until missionaries come in teach us those words. The very notion of property doesn't have a place in Indian discourse until we're taught to value private ownership of property under missionary tutelage. Because you see, our lands were always held in common. It was the people that held the land. The people that belong to a particular place, even then, the word ownership had no currency because there were no owners of the land. So in my time in Australia, the Australian Aboriginal people taught me to think in terms of the Aboriginal owners of the land. That's what they call themselves. Remind white Australians, we're the Aboriginal owners of the land. Yet that doesn't quite work here. I'm not sure it works really well in Australia either, because we never thought of the land as something we owned. The land was a relative. We were in relationship to that place that's now called Missouri. We never owned it, which is a very different concept than John Locke had in mind, the great English philosopher of the late 17th century, the father of democracy, the hero of Thomas Jefferson, who said Indians don't own any land. Like the Episcopal ministers in London who were preaching sermons in support of the Jamestown colony in 1609 repeated that claim long before Locke. Indians don't own any land. John Winthrop said it. Indians merely roam the land. They make fructitory youths of the land. That is, they're hunter-gatherers and harvest foods from trees. Because we didn't fit into that Christian frame of the world, we couldn't keep our lands. There's something deeply, deeply wrong with that kind of thinking. Surely we can make room for people to view the world differently than others do. Surely we can make room for those who want to see the land as a relative rather than a piece of real estate, a piece of property open for personal ownership or even group ownership. See, the problem is that European mind is firmly rooted in that hierarchy of what linguists call an up-down image schema. It's a hierarchical way of thinking and conceiving reality. Everything is hierarchical. There's always a king or a president. There's always a bishop. And under that, preachers who stand above congregations. And below that, lay people who have no status in the church other than as the faithful who are supposed to donate and pick up the salary of those who are higher up in the hierarchy, with apologies to the bishop of this diocese who spoke to us a while ago, and other bishops. But that's the scheme of things. It's hierarchical. And that hierarchy extends to a hierarchy of human beings over everything else in the world. Implicitly and explicitly through the generations, that hierarchy has been expressed in terms of white people over black people, white people over Indians, white people over people of color. There's another part of the hierarchy. Men over women, parents over children. Doesn't work that way in our Indian world, because we have more of an egalitarian, collateral egalitarian perspective of the world rather than this up-down hierarchy, so that our children are not below us. They have their own life and they need to be respected by their parents, just as we teach them to respect others and to respect us. But more than that, we're in a relationship with all kinds of relatives who are on an equal plane with us, including not just other human beings, but the birds and the squirrels outside, the grasses, the trees, everything on the earth that moves is in relationship with us. No matter how slowly they seem to move, because, see, mountains and hills are our relatives. I have a colleague in Denver who shares duties of spiritual leadership in our community, who got a job as a kind of a mining engineer, a practical engineer, helping to bore holes in the earth, testing for oil shale drilling. And he finally turned up a beautiful, beautiful stone from 15 meters below the surface of the earth. And he took that stone, he brought it to us into ceremony, sat with it, talked to it, what you all call prayed with it, and summarily decided that rock was a sign to him that he needed to quit drilling holes in the earth. And he quit a very high-paying job and is now suffering with a much lower-paying job. The same man was with us when we were doing some maintenance work around Four Winds. had a lot of Indian young people there with us, helping us to clean up the grounds around Four Winds and do some minor maintenance on the building itself. And one young man, about 15, went out into the middle of the front yard in front of the building, leaned over and cleared his throat, spit into the grass. Witaka Latoni went over to the young man, put his arm around him, said, "Young man, you don't want to do that. This grass is your relative. You need to show it more respect than that. Come here. Come over here to the sidewalk. See this sidewalk? It's cement. Some human being made this. If you need to spit, come spit on the sidewalk." Just the opposite of what our white relatives would tell the young man, right? That's the difference that relationship makes. So if we're going to change things, what I argued for this afternoon and want to say again to all of you is, then we need to begin to frame the world differently, starting with framing it in terms of interrelationship with each other, interrelationship with everything that moves, interrelationship with Muslim brothers and sisters, interrelationship Indian to Christian, so that you and I can, in a genuine way, look at each other and call each other Wodondakide, relatives. I don't know how we get there, but we've got to start moving in that direction. I can't tell you how to get there. We need to do that together, not with some hierarchical directive from some Indian with a sweet tongue who can talk you into thinking a particular way. But we need to work on it together as relatives. Kakuna, Witawadonda Kirithani.
And our last speaker, before we go to the panel discussion, is Kim Rikalma Kludisi. And she, in 2010, won the Echo Trust Indigenous Leadership Award. And I just want to read some of the categories that were involved in her winning that award. She was given the award as an activist, a political organizer, a cross-cultural interpreter, a teacher, an academic researcher of ethnobotany, a reporter, a photographer, a historian, award-winning videographer, and a producer. She's devoted her life to learning, teaching, interpreting, and preserving the culture of her people, the heritage and the history of her people. She's recognized as an expert on intellectual property rights, and she's advocated for the revision of Canadian policies on repatriating sacred artifacts. That's just a little bit of who this person is. We welcome her this evening. Thanks so much.
Gela Kisla. I want to begin today by remembering what we did this morning. We traveled for 2 days to come here from the mid-coast of British Columbia. My name is Ogwilogwa, and I traveled with my husband Kwaksistala and his adopted son Kasleet from Vancouver Island to be here with you today. And as we traveled this way, we talked the entire time of what we must do in order to come to this land, even though we drove a car, drove on a ferry. Quoxy Stella, who was secluded from the authorities and never allowed to go to school and trained only in our culture because he is the last of the firstborn to connect to the beginning of time, explained that when you come to another's land, you never set foot on it, especially in the times of old, because we would have come in a dugout canoe. We would have, that's our people, because we're seafaring people. So he said, we must bring a paddle. And the paddle you see below you, he made himself. My sister painted it. Maybe we can hold it up. It is the symbol of that journey that we made. Typically, we would have stood on the face of the canoe and sung a song to let you know we're coming in peace. My dear brothers and sisters, the European visitors got it all wrong. Not one of them came symbolizing that they recognized the ownership of the ancestors of this land. I'm using English words, but our own words talk about the responsibility and obligations and the stewardship obligations that go far beyond fee simple ownership. There are strict laws that govern how we treat our territories. And the entire discovery of our lands is still happening. But it happened on a false premise. It happened on a premise that said we didn't know how to greet each other. We didn't know how to have good relations, and that we didn't have organized structures that carried us through our lives. For goodness sakes, my brother, who is a commercial fisherman since he was 4, said, we did this kind of work for 10,000 years. Oh, this government screwed it up in a century. We have to understand something. Even when we work commercially in some areas, our minds are always orderly. We are always thinking, and we're speaking almost a secondary English. We're always framing everything that we're doing. Is this the right way to greet people? Is this the right way to recognize where you're from? We're always scanning with our computer brains to see where you are and who you are so that we can make it move smoothly. And these poor young men that are part of our world and young women that are poor, and I say poor because they don't realize that things come, gifting comes with bungee cords and subpoenas and all kinds of obligations that come back when we say we're driving to Portland, you'll drive with us. Didn't realize that some of the naming included that. So when people came, and I'm actually related to somebody that received a mace from one of the sovereigns in Captain Vancouver's expedition on the Inside Passage, it kind of hangs somewhere in a closet because they don't know the significance of it. Nor did they accept that it was being planted in the name of some kind of ownership. You need to know that that chieftainship still operates. Those people still work on that land. And a treaty's never been signed in that area. So as far as the law is concerned in many of these areas, it didn't stick. The doctrine of discovery is an interesting concept for me because I come from a land where the last colonizers hit the coast. So what happened in our territory happened in a very accelerated manner, and it happened in a manner that learned from the mistakes made here and made in other parts of the world. We are, as you are, living the end game of colonization. We all are. all of us, no matter who we are, whether we're tribal or not. We're living that end game. We still think in fragments. We're lucky enough that we still have people that have a direct tie and never stop those teachings. But for most people in our tribal communities, we suffer and struggle generationally from the oppression that took place. Because our people were such strong, in English, that was akin to a stock market. We had an investment system, and it kept everybody quite solidified. It was hierarchical, but it wasn't one over the other. It was for orderliness. It was very, very, very carefully organized. I am a potlatch recorder left over from that time, but I never saw the real Pasa. Coxy Stella was the last man ever initiated in the real Pasa. It was a combination of an economy, our religion, and also our culture. Everything was moved through there. It paid dividends, and you invested in each other. We still have a remnant of that, but mostly we have some really good business people in our area, because that's how our culture worked, always working through there. I would say every culture across North America had a similar function and a similar system. It was ordered a little differently, but they had similar strengths to be able to survive and thrive in these lands. So I believe that the newcomers who came with their flags and their fancy button pants and shirts and jackets, we have a lot of stories of the first people that came to the coast. We learned how to drink from the maritime fur traders. We didn't have a fermented drink on our coast. We did not have any of the ails that ailed people. No virgin soil diseases were on our coast before. So a lot of gifts came with those first encounters very quickly. Within the first 75 years of having maritime fur trade, people never lived here. They just traded furs for the first bit of their encounter. But it left our people devastated via population from the measles and smallpox and the virgin soil diseases. When this area became populated and the Hudson's Bay Company moved north to Victoria, they had to get serious. And that was when the first colony was set up on Vancouver Island. It wasn't even a British colony. It was a proprietorial colony. It was granted to the Hudson's Bay fur factor, James Douglas. So he knew how to exploit the people, because he'd been a trader. He traded, not a traitor, but that came later. He became a trader. He was the trader. But that was later converted into a full-blown colony when gold was discovered. Something in the water in British Columbia, I don't know what happened. There were a few very small historic treaties that were signed, but no exchange, monetary exchange, happened because the British government argued over who would pay for it. Does that sound a bit like what happens in other places? They argued, so they stopped making treaties, and Douglas didn't want to take from his profits, so they stopped making treaties and stopped doing the other work. It wasn't until gold was discovered and there was a need to put a railway across that the lands were gazetted, 100% without the consent of the people. So in British Columbia, we're experiencing a very interesting time. All of the things that happened in the rest of North America happened, but without the luxury of having actual clear ownership, fee simple ownership of the land. It's in question still in many parts of British Columbia, approximately 85% of British Columbia. So we'll just see how the world unfolds. We did unfortunately have the residential school system, which is like the boarding school system. It was very systematic. On the heels of the depopulation in the 1860s, reserves were set up and people were corralled onto small reserves in 1870s. And within a few years of that, our religion, our culture, and our potlatch system, our economic system, were outlawed until 1951. And our children were removed until the 1980s to go to boarding schools. Language was denied. Denied so much so that some died of beating, my own uncle did, in the residential school. How do you deal with that? I think the only reason why some have is because our closeness to those ancestral ties and the customs had not been broken for a long, many generations before that started. We have a system in place in most of the cultures in British Columbia that still have some remnants left. It is becoming thin. Where can we make these changes? Well, there was a class action suit in 2006 that began the whole Canadian phenomena of truth and reconciliation, and I want to be very clear to say that hasn't been a kind experience for most. Tied to the settlement, my father and I worked for years with the prime ministers and the ministers of Indian Affairs to say don't, do not. Do not do this. Do not pay people. Do not have a sliding scale. Because in Canada, all of the boarding schools were church-run. Not only were they church-run, but they were church-profited. Nobody had oversight. If less could be spent, less happened. There were studies done on malnutrition. There were studies done, and most of the vaccinations were tested on the children. There was some mass sterilization that took place, in particular in our Indian hospitals, well into the 1970s that took place until my folks put a stop to it. Last residential school closed on Vancouver Island in the 1980s, so we're not talking about ancient history, we're talking about recent history. So to talk about reconciliation is like saying to somebody who is a victim of childhood abuse, you're going to get over it now. We're going to be friends. What can you do to help me feel better about hearing your story? And that is the skinny of it. There was a huge commission that was set up. And once the stories were told and they're housed in Winnipeg and all the ceremonies took place, the counseling ended. We should be having traditionally run treatment centers all across our country, counseling all across our country. Our jobs and what has happened between our people and the churches in Canada has been more about how to heal that relationship rather than to sort out how to deal with intergenerational trauma. That is no different than the crisis you have here in the United States with veterans. I really, really want to encourage each and